Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From our studios at KUOM on the West Bank of the University of Minnesota campus, this is Culture Q, the art show that rocks. This week on Culture Q, just a normal show.
We interrupt your scheduled programming to bring you a transmission from another dimension. A dimension of pure sound. A world of both arts and cultural reporting. We ask that you step with us now into the Culture Cue. With me, your host, Mark Sheely, we have the next half hour of stories brought to you from the darkest corners of the deepest corridors of the human psyche. So sit back, do try to relax, because this transmission begins right now. We begin with a story from a house of haunts. Each year, the Soap Factory hosts a rogues gallery of blood-chilling thrills within its basement. But in the world of Culture Q, reporter Robert Schoen investigates how even this menagerie of horrors itself can play host to lifelong love and even an unexpected peck.
Stop the things you do! What's up?
My name is Lillian Egner. I am the program manager here at the Soap Factory, and my role involves working with artists and installations and volunteers, but with the Haunted Basement, it's especially exciting because I get to work with a huge team of collaborative artists and get to see 10,000 people get super scared every October.
Why don't you just first off tell me a little bit about the Haunted Basement for some background?
Sure. The Haunted Basement is a program here at the Soap Factory. We're a contemporary art gallery that's been around for almost 25 years, located near the Stone Arch Bridge in Minneapolis. And the Haunted Basement is an amazing project that we've been doing for 6 years now. This year we are working with Noah Bremer, who is a local theater director who's taken on the project, and he is working with our actors and our artists to work on the concepts, the design, construction, and acting in the Haunted Basement this year.
So let's dive into one of these rooms and see what makes our stomachs churn so much when we enter them.
There are two rooms that really scare me this year in particular. One of them involves walking into a fairly normal, fairly welcoming, smells wonderful, looks polite bedroom of a brand new newborn baby. And let's just say that things have gone awry, and that monster you always thought was in your closet as a kid, yeah, they actually exist.
And what is people's reaction while they're going through that room, or while they're in it even?
We actually had two people pee in their pants in that room. Separate groups. The narrative for one particular room a few years back was a very ghostly female character who surprised, and there was a simple jump scare, a very dark passageway, the patrons walking through distracted by a video feed of actually themselves walking towards themselves, which is very distracting in the dark. They're trying to figure out what's coming around next. This ghostly female character pops out of the dark, and gentleman in his 40s or 50s, what I would call a mature adult, grabbed her and gave her a huge smooch. And she just, her eyes widened, his eyes widened, and she screamed bloody murder, and he took off running.
A somewhat romantic side has appeared to this horrific place, and it continued to reoccur after Lillian told me this next story.
In 2012, we were actually lucky enough to have a young couple celebrate their wedding with us. They had their very first date here in 2007 at the Haunted Basement. They love terror, they love horror movies, and they love the Haunted Basement. They've come every single year. So when they wanted to have an unusual wedding ceremony at the Haunted Basement, they got married right before they went through, had a few of their friends as their wedding party, and they got married at the top of the stairs, heard the rules, learned about the uncle rule, and went down through the basement. They had the best time.
There might not be a lot of love coming from haunted houses in general, but at the Soap Factory, there are some definite connections. I'm Robert Schoen for Culture Q.
This year, on November 1st, we must warn you, One Art Gallery will be bringing those we have lost back from the dead. It's a part of the Mexican Day of the Dead, or Dia de los Muertos. Reporter Amy Friedman looks at how art and color help bring life to the dead on this traditional Mexican holiday.
Black is death's color of choice. The Grim Reaper would never step outside without his black hooded cape. The black bird is an omen of death, and at funerals, we all have to wear black. Well, the Mexican holiday, Day of the Dead, has some advice for death. Lighten up a little.
If color wasn't a part of it, if it was dark and all about blacks and reds and grays, well then it might be a little more like Halloween.
Amber White is the director of group exhibitions at Minneapolis's art gallery, Altered Aesthetics. At Altered Aesthetics, each year, death reveals its true colors in their Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, exhibit.
And it's an exhibition as well as sort of a celebration, and we do a candlelight vigil, but also it's a time for us to gather and talk about people that we've lost and remember them either through artwork or through our candlelight vigil.
For those of us who haven't grown up with this holiday, it can seem like a foreign way to think about death. Americans don't really have an equivalent. Funerals are somber, Halloween is scary, Memorial Day is serious. But Day of the Dead is something else.
What we see, though, with Day of the Dead is it's not a funeral. It's a celebration of life and people being able to come back for one brief moment to be with the people they loved and cared about when they were alive.
Michael Duenas of the University of Minnesota Chicano and Latino Studies Department explains just how different this tone is. It is a tone of celebration. And if there is one symbol that defines this unusual tone, it is the sugar skull. These are skulls adorned with only the loudest colors and only the loudest designs. They are fun. They change everything that we know a skull to mean.
The sugar skulls are really just to represent that mortality and death is part of the cycle of life, and it's not to be feared, so put it everywhere, basically, so that people get used to seeing it and learn not to fear it.
And maybe they're just a little bit defiant.
But traditionally, it would be a sugar skull. You would pick one with your name on it, and then you would eat it. In that sense, demonstrating you're not scared of death and you recognize it.
Amber White explains why Sugar Skulls Art and her Dia de los Muertos exhibit are essential to understanding death and loss.
The role that art plays just in celebrations of any sort is a visual one, but also a visual communication and communicating things that are harder to verbalize, I think, especially with remembering our dead.
The Day of the Dead is a rejection of denial. It is about facing death and eating that sugar skull. It is about honesty.
our American holiday, Halloween, being really gory, scary, almost, I think, comical sometimes in the way that we perceive death. Dia de los Muertos takes a more really honest look at death and accepting it as part of our lives and remembering those who have passed.
This is the dance that brings the dead to the living.
And, you know, there's that saying that you don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been.
For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
In case you need a moment to orient yourself, for our question of the week, new reporter Maria Mary Rupero decided to ask, out of all the boulevards, avenues, roads, and drives, what is your favorite street?
Oak is awesome because it reminds me of the environment.
Bloomington Ave. Why? Do you want to know why? Oh, because every time my GPS says Bloomington, I want to go to Bloomington, or every time I like click in Bloomington, it gives me Bloomington Ave. So somehow I manage up in the wrong place.
I don't really have one.
No, Washington, he loves Ave. All the streets. Why Washington? He lives on Washington.
Well, I live close to there, and Washington, I mean, it's after George Washington. What was there not to like? But it's pretty common, but still good.
I like Lee, because it's my last name.
I like the street name Minnehaha. Because it's fun to say, and I don't know, has a lot of character.
My favorite street could be Hiawatha, because of the poem, the Hiawatha Laughing Water thing.
Lozang Avenue, maybe.
One thing that ticks me off, though, is that downtown we have like 4th Street and 4th Avenue, and they kind of run like parallel, and when I give people directions, you know, they mix that up. It's kind of frustrating.
Well, in St. Louis Park, I worked near YZ, and I guess I just like the way that sounds. Not too often you get the W, the Y, and the Z in one name.
My favorite street name in the Twin Cities would be L'Orient, because it's the first street I remember, and I basically grew up on that street.
My favorite street, it's Colfax, yeah. I think it's Colfax, yeah. Yeah, because I'm living there, because I have a friend over there. Yeah, they look nice, they look friendly, so that's why I choose the Colfax too.
Thanks for tuning into Radio K. I'm Courtney, here with Matt, and we are going to count down the top 7 most inappropriate places to wear a costume. What with Halloween coming up, there's going to be a lot of people walking around in costumes, but really there are just some situations in which you should not ever wear a costume.
Our number 7 is a bank.
You just don't want to dress up as a robber or something scary when you walk into a bank, just because there's so many people that will walk in and try and steal money, or banks always have that fear.
How often does it happen?
I don't know.
Do you know? I don't know. Do you know the statistics?
Maybe a lot.
What about on Halloween? Is it like a specific, is it like an increase in?
Maybe.
You have no idea.
I have no idea.
You don't know. You don't know anything. You don't know the statistics of bank robberies on Halloween.
No, I have no idea.
But it's equally dangerous, so just don't do it.
Just don't do it.
Don't cause a ruckus. Number 6 is the dentist. Another boring place to go, which will also cause a ruckus. Because the dentist is scary enough as it is.
Yeah, you don't need a costume to make it scarier.
Oh, snap.
And honestly, if you're going to have a giant costume on, it's just going to make the whole already uncomfortable situation of have your teeth cleaned or getting a root canal, it's just going to become exponentially more uncomfortable if you're wearing a costume.
You have to take the mask off.
Yeah.
It's going to smell like rubber.
Our number 5 is a church.
They're not. I don't think they're very Halloween orientated.
No.
I think they're more of an Easter kind of.
Yeah, place. I think so.
Easter, Christmas.
Maybe if you are going to wear a costume to church, wait until Easter and come dressed up as a bunny or something like that. Number four day is moving in day for college. This is kind of obvious, I think. You don't want to show up to your dorm with your roommate there dressed in some costume because your roommate will think that you are a freak.
It's the first impression, and first impressions are worst impressions when you look like a moron. So just be careful.
Yeah, and you know what your roommate's going to be thinking if you show up in a costume? They're going to be thinking, oh my god, do I really have to live with this person for the next 9 months?
Unless you move in on Halloween, I think that would be probably appropriate. But not many people do.
But you really don't. School usually starts back in August or September.
Yeah, and that's more of a... There's no holidays in the summer. We need to sort that
There's no reason.
What holidays would you suggest to have in the summer, other than Halloween?
I don't know. There's like Labor Day.
Labor Day? That's not a... You don't dress up on Labor Day.
Exactly. So if
you could dress up as a laborer.
A laborer. Our number three is an airplane, or perhaps even more inappropriately, the point when you're walking through airport security and having to deal with TSA.
TSA don't have much fun.
If you walk through TSA dressed in some sort of costume, they will probably assume that you're a terrorist.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Or just a flamboyant human who enjoys Halloween. Number two is the American embassy in any country, in any place in the world, because they also don't have much fun. Anything to do with Homeland Security in America, they take this job pretty seriously. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been there?
I haven't,
it's
actually.
Not a lot of fun. So it'll be a waste of a visa. It'll be a waste of your time. And just don't do it. It's just not worth it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So our number one most inappropriate place to wear a costume is a funeral.
Because dead people are there. Yeah. And if you dress up as a dead person, it's like, oh, look. There's more than one dead person here. It's confusing.
It is confusing.
That's probably the main problem. Mm-hmm. Other than it's really inappropriate, I guess.
Yeah.
It's
disrespectful.
Also a problem. Mm-hmm. I think the confusion is the most thing, because then they'll be looking at you in the stands and be like, well, is that the dead guy? And then you'll have to be like, no, the dead guy is obviously in the box over there.
Yeah.
It's a simple misunderstanding, but it can cause quite a ruckus. As you can imagine.
We're going to have so many ruckuses if you guys... If you guys ever wear a costume to any of these places that we listed.
Just stop. Stop doing it. But like, just try to avoid these places. Like, reschedule your dentist appointment. Don't go to the bank and try to steal anything. Don't get your visa. Or just don't wear a costume. But like, that's not much fun.
Each year around Halloween, custom Lego shop Brick Mania in Northeast Minneapolis hosts a Brick or Treat event. Reporter Mitch Skinner looks at how they've built a hobby into a business, brick by brick.
Whether they're building sets or just playing with blocks, kids can't seem to get enough of Lego. The toy has been around for over 50 years, but it's still proven its lasting power. Maybe it's because you can use them to build just about anything.
Lego is here. Hey, kids, look. A whole new world to build.
Well, like this ship behind you. There's a battleship behind you. That particular project was about a two-year project. It's built all out of Lego bricks. It's almost 8 feet long.
This is Dan Siskind, owner of Brick Mania in Northeast Minneapolis. His company sells custom Lego sets. They also have a monthly open house for showing off all their coolest designs.
So the ship took about a year to build. A lot of it wasn't, you know, it was just waiting for it so I could afford to buy the next round of pieces. It took up my roommate's dining room table. And at a certain point, I was like, well, she probably wants her dining room table back. So I built a stand out of a bunch of excess bricks that I had laying around. So
this month, Brick Mania opened its doors to the public twice for their annual Brick or Treat event. Volunteers put together a variety of displays, including the Bates Motel from the movie Psycho, and a scene from the film Shaun of the Dead. But that doesn't mean the designers don't get creative with their displays.
you know, the Winchester pub is your typical British pub with the pub down a lower level and then the innkeeper's residence in the upper parts. Well, that's kind of boring when you put that on a train layout. So I said, well, let's fill it with Monty Python scenes. So you asked, said something about the Superman on the street. There's a Monty Python sketch about bicycle repairmen, and that's what that's from.
But despite the creativity in some of the designs and all the hours they took to build, Dan Siskind is very reluctant to call what he does art.
I don't know. I'm an artist. According to the Northeast Artists, you know, the NEMA organization. But I don't know. I take it with a grain of salt. It's really, it's just a toy, you know. But, I mean, we like to not take ourselves very seriously, you know. Sure, there's definitely artistic part of it. There's a process. And
that process didn't form overnight. Siskind has been at this for about 40 years. After that amount of time, you get pretty good at putting bricks together.
I don't want to sound like I have a huge ego or something, but you know, I guess I have skills and techniques that I've learned just by immersing myself in it. And same with the other people involved, that it's definitely we're not at entry level, but it's art form, I don't know.
But I couldn't get over how visually striking some of these designs were. Dragons and castles, scenes from movies, a huge motorized train track. It takes a lot of time and energy to build. That's why it really hit me hard when Siskind told me these sets actually get taken apart. Once Brickmania and the volunteers want to display something new, they go down. I felt a pang of discomfort when he told me this, and I had nothing to do with building the displays.
Well, it's part of Lego, you know. It's a toy, and as much, you know, some of the models that we have in here have hundreds of hours of building time put into them. But in the end of the day, we don't glue anything together, and it's all just, you know, there's always something bigger and better that can be built.
But maybe it's just because I'm too old to get it. Siskind told me that there are essentially two types of people who buy their sets. There are the collectors who put everything together, put it on a shelf, and might never touch it again. And then there are the kids who play with the Lego.
The kids who buy it to play with it, they are, you know, oh, it's the coolest thing. I like the way that this hatch opens up and you know, all the stuff works on it. And they'll tell you about all the cool things they've done with it. And it's great. You know, I like to get that feedback too.
So do you prefer it then when people actually play with your sets?
I try to make it so it's a little bit of both. The average set will be average, you know, weighted between halfway between playability and build, you know, building skill and building experience.
And that certainly comes up in Brickmania's open house events. There is a playroom where kids can touch and play with all the bricks they want, but most of the actual displays have signs on them asking the audience not to touch.
Basically, there's a lot of displays. Some of the things are look at only. I mean, we don't encourage people to grab the trains while they're running. We've had some pretty big disasters, so you look and you don't touch. But we do have bricks available, bricks out, so kids and adults can play.
And that's just how it goes with a toy. Whether it's a hobby or an art form, kids are going to want to play with Lego designs. And adults just might want to play with them, too.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's what I basically do. If I could still do this in 5 to 10 years, I'll be happy. We have a 10-year lease on the space. We put so much work into it, I didn't want to see, like, let's put a bunch of work into a space and then have to move after a couple of years. So we're fairly comfortable we're going to be doing this for a while.
With Culture Q, I'm Mitch Skinner.
People tell a lot of ghost stories around Halloween. But for some, ghosts aren't the supernatural figures we read about in books or see in movies. Producer Noel Clark caught up with author and essayist Anne Elizabeth Moore, who shares with us a different kind of ghost story.
Hi, my name is Anne Elizabeth Moore, and I have a new book called Hip Hop Opsera, Ghosts Past and Present. It's about great economic change in a country that's suffered a series of horrible disasters, traumas, and difficulties, and is just now learning to talk about it and recover and move on through great public dance parties that are held in the only public space in the city. The essays don't have titles. They each sort of describe different aspects of contemporary Cambodian culture and this is about a woman. Professional young Witlia is an intelligent and forward-thinking Cambodian woman. She is from a traditional family, but somehow they have adapted to her modern ways and accept her for who she is. She uses slang, she wears short sleeves, her hair is merely shoulder length instead of running all the way down her back to her butt, which is not a part of her body her family would acknowledge her owning, but she would. She has a butt. She won't wiggle it or giggle, even in jest, like some of these younger girls on the street in their Korean mini dresses and makeup. But unlike her family, she can talk to such women about many topics. She sees they have things in common. Witlia has a job. She is in charge of an organization devoted to promoting women's leadership in the developing nation. When she was little, Witlia did not know that such jobs existed. She was born in 1977 in a period of deep poverty, oppression, and violence. Around 2 million people were killed between 1975 and 1979 in a drive to return the nation into a utopic agrarian state. The ruling party first killed off intellectuals and former government officials who might balk, then the artists and the dreamers. People who looked French, people with glasses. Many who weren't murdered died of starvation or exhaustion from overwork. The dead were buried in mass graves all over the country, some of which are still being discovered. Bodies continue to be found. Sometimes femurs just appear emerging from the earth or skulls. Those that weren't killed had spirits crushed through forced remarriage, rape, beating, hunger, other abuses. They died too in a way, perhaps in a more significant way. Those who weren't killed rarely talk about those who were. Those who survived do not explain how. School textbooks, newspapers, documentaries, few tell the story of the Khmer Rouge. Few want to hear it. But if you understand a little bit about math and hear some small things about them, you quickly realize that Witlia's parents were married by force. Her mother's old marriage dissolved under a new law, no ceremony, no goodbyes. The first husband was sent to a different province to work, and her mother never heard from him again. Witlia does not even know he existed, but she knows that her mother's mourning is deep and inexplicable. She knows there is an absence. She can feel it there, but she does not know what it used to contain. Witlia is having a hard time in her new job. First of all, she's never met a woman who has one, a job. There just aren't many employment opportunities for women in the country. So when she is at her office, all of her friends are still at home helping mothers cook and clean or sitting with babies. Maybe they all live in the same home, her friends, their mothers, and their babies. They probably do. She doesn't even know anymore. She is losing touch with them. She comes home at night and what? She does not know in advance what she will eat for dinner with her family. She is surprised every day. How do people live like this, traveling from home to a job and back, so much traveling? She receives a paycheck as well, and has a responsibility now as a member of the middle class. It is a new thing in Cambodia, the middle class. It is important to maintain an appearance, to eat at fast food restaurants, as she has seen teenagers do in American movies, to own a Toyota Camry, to wear a different outfit every day, to appear outside after dark in public places. Also, it is a lot of responsibility, listening to young women who want to be leaders. The government and businesses do not want them to be leaders anyway. The young women struggle. Their school tells them they should not try to study like men. Advertisements point out that they are the wrong color and too fat. The government says they are only good for making babies. Their fathers tell them they are not respectful. Sometimes the young women agree. It is sad for Witlia how slowly things change, but it is also sad how quickly. She has a cell phone. Last year, she did not know what a cell phone was. It is all a lot to juggle. So Witlia is seeing a healer, a traditional healer who uses potions and future-telling and feathers, and something like hypnotism to try to cure Witlia of what she has been diagnosed with, and what really is the problem. Witlia is scared of ghosts.
And that is all for our transmission this evening from The Culture Cue. Contributors to this week's show were Robert Schoen, Amy Friedman, Maria Merivupero, Matt Curtis, Courtney Bade, Mitch Skinner, and Noel Clark. Producers for Culture Q are Mitch Skinner, Noel Clark, Markita Fornoff, and Amy Friedman. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and host and managing editor is me, Mark Sheely. You can find Culture Q on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And if you miss something fascinating, you can always find recent episodes of Culture Q online at radiok.org. Thanks for listening, and as always, we hope you join us next week. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.